Great, so nice to be here. Look forward to everybody's talks on the symbolism of the tantric path. I would like to dedicate this talk to my teachers. As I was sort of just thinking about sort of giving the talk, I feel so grateful, so grateful to all my teachers. I feel really grateful to Bhante Sagarakshita. But then preparing this, I've been reading Lama Govinda as well. So Lama Govinda was a German Lama who was older than Sangharakshita and who had been all round Tibet with his partner and consort Lee Gotami, sort of documenting Tibet. You know, thank goodness that they did it before the invasion of Tibet by China. So. And he was a practitioner as well. They were both practitioners as well. So Sangharakshita learnt lots from Lama Govinda. And another guy called Giuseppe Tucci, who was also a friend of Lama Govinda's. And he's an old-time art historian who also went around sort of documenting everything. So I feel very, very grateful to those people, especially as I feel like a bit of an unworthy student. This is such a huge topic. So I'm just going to give a little bit, and there are so many people here who could give this talk, and they would all give it slightly differently, and perhaps in 3 months' time I would give it slightly differently. So there's just so many different aspects to Tantra and to the stupa. So I've picked out a little trajectory, and we can just take from that what we will. So the symbolism of the tantric stupa, and I've... unfortunately, in the conversion, there's some things that haven't been worked out on the slide. So I've tried to define Tantra. I mean, why did I volunteer to say I could do a little bit on Tantra? So I hope everybody will... I'm going to keep looking at Dumb City. I hope everyone will add their bits, actually, because I've got a mind that likes history. So I always bring that out whenever I'm giving talks and stuff. So... someone else will bring out something more sort of punchy or vital, or a different aspect of Tantra. So Tantra, it means loom, warp, or web. So sutra is thread. So sutra is just a thread that you sort of follow, and Tantra is more the web or the loom, which the sort of the which things sit on. So it's got a sense of continuum. So sort of Tantra comes from that sort of, from I think ta is loom or warp, warp or web. And then there's also an implication of knowledge, because if you've got a sort of a whole picture, somehow you've got more knowledge, haven't you? So there's that link with sort of jnana and knowledge. So it's about an expansive, all-encompassing reality revealed by wisdom. So that's a sort of a definition of Tantra in a way. Expansive, all-encompassing reality revealed by wisdom. And Tantra also means systems, doctrines, compendiums, corpus of texts. So you can talk about the Tantra as a sort of system of texts and practices. Or you can talk about Tantra as the practices. I'm practicing Tantra. So... it emerged from the Mahayana, so innovations within the Mahayana. Sometimes, the early Tantra is called Mantrayana, because they were using mantras to develop their sort of practices. And then later, of course, it's called Vajrayana and esoteric Buddhism. So these are all similar sorts of terms for Tantra. The first texts appeared in the mid-8th century. So the practices were happening about, from about 100 years earlier. And it was both, it was led by Buddhist practitioners, but it was Buddhist and non-Buddhist, like Hindu practitioners. They're all sort of working, practicing together. There wasn't a sort of strict sort of delineation of who was who. It was all working together. But it was established within Tibet by about the late 11th century. So Tantra also moved into Japan and China in the 7th century. So that's early sort of Tantra. So that's what you get in Japan and China, moving across. They get stuck with Vairochana, but they don't get stuck with Vairochana. But it's that they have an early form of Tantra in Japan, Shingon schools, and that doesn't develop in the same way that later on it does in Tibet. So then in Tibet, it sort of develops into different levels, but what they call the highest yoga tantra by about the 11th century, and it just continues to bubble out and create and develop and stretch our imaginations from there. So the difference is that ritual practices become really, really central. So there's this new emphasis on ritual. Deity yoga is a new development, including the use of mantras. So deity yoga is where you imagine yourself, you visualize yourself as the as your yidam, or you develop a sadhana practice based on that. So that's a Vajrayana or a tantric kind of practice, and you identify. You're trying to identify with that figure that's outside, so that there's no outside and inside. You become that figure. And when we're ordained into the Triratna Buddhist order, we're given visualization practices that sort of link with this. So next comes another feature is this initiation and consecration rites passed down from teacher to disciple. So it's within the context of our ordination that we are given our this practice of visualization. So it's within this sort of initiation. That's kind of a secret esoteric part. So lots of this, isn't written down for a long time. It gets sort of systematized and things over the years, over the centuries. But these things are passed from teacher to disciple, teacher to disciple, teacher to disciple. That's a very, very important part of that lineage is very important. And then the sort of the great Mahayana burst of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, they start to get organized and clustered into mandalas. So that sort of sense kind of made by all these sort of Buddhas. So the five Buddha mandala starts to appear. And the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas and the Buddhas are kind of are put into families and sort of given sort of associations. And there's a shift from Shakyamuni as the central figure of the mandala to Vairochana. So that's what happens with Japanese, with the Buddha, with Tantra that moves to Japan. They stop there, or that's where they go. But then later on, Vairochana gets displaced by Akshobhya. Akshobhya holds the Vajra. So it's the Vajrayana. So he becomes the centre of the mandala. So Akshobhya Vajrasattva. And within Tantra, the other aspect is that you bring the whole of yourself onto the path. So the use of desire and sexual yoga, as well as violence, I'll explain that in a second, and other affective emotions. So you... bring everything, transform everything. That's the sort of heart of the Tantra. Don't leave anything behind. So you've got desire, use it, bring it onto the path. You've got feelings of, you've hatred. Right, how does that manifest? How can you bring that and transform that hatred into love? In earlier systems of meditation, you sort of have the hindrances and you work on the hindrances through, blue sky mind and cultivating the opposite and all these sorts of things. In Tantra, it's kind of different, isn't it? You sort of, you engage with it and you might even visualize very wrathful figures that embody that energy, and you use that to sort of break through. And I think right at the bottom, I've just missed off here, it says the symbol is the Vajra. So that's the key to the Tantra. And I've put this up here. I think this is probably a later text, but here are our early tantric practitioners, and they're a motley wild bunch. So these are the yogis and the adepts, and you know what's now sort of the sadhus, or sometimes called the forest renunciants. So here they are doing their yoga. So yoga and tantra are completely developing together. So what we've got is the yogis, really, the sort of people outside the monasteries, probably not always, but sort of outside the monasteries, practicing new forms of meditation. So yoga, breath control. They're sort of interested in unifying male and female energies, more sense of how do you work with subtle body energies, and they want to achieve liberation within this lifetime. So I don't know where I've put this. I'll probably end up saying this again or miss a bit. In the Mahayana, enlightenment's so long away, isn't it? It's like you never get enlightened because you're putting it off. Because the idea is that all beings are brought onto the path. And so this idea of enlightenment is in kalpas and kalpas and aeons and who knows when. And somehow I get a sense through the practices of yoga, and perhaps there's a sort of a bit of a reaction over time to this myth of the sort of the bodhisattva who sort of puts up their own enlightenment. These Mahasiddhas are sort of going for it. They're seeing that enlightenment is really possible in this lifetime because their yoga practices are showing them that it's possible. So they're cracking through something. So you get these Mahasiddhas. The great spiritually accomplished ones. And the Tibetan schools are really, really hot, or really, really concerned to show that their lineages go back to these Indian adepts. So you get Naropa and Tilopa as the founders of the Kama Kagyu, and you get Virupa for the Shakyas and Tsongkhapa, who's sometimes then shown that he's a monk, but he's shown as a Mahasiddha as well. Sometimes he's depicted as a Mahasiddha for the Gelug tradition. So they're really concerned that the Tibetan tradition that sort of starts in the 10th and 11th centuries is founded on authentic Indian Buddhism. They're really concerned to do that. And that goes back to these tantric practitioners, these Mahasiddhas. So these yogis, they represent the abandonment of worldly life and embracing a more ascetic lifestyle as a means to discipline the mind and to reach enlightenment. They are going for it. So they're not preserving the texts, they're not writing out the texts. That became a very big Mahayana practice, which was fantastic. They're just going to gain enlightenment in one lifetime. So there we go, here's the Tantra, developed from yoga and ritual practices. Was a reaction or a response to the Mahayana vision where enlightenment was postponed forever, and you're bringing the whole of your experience and your whole of yourself onto your path. Everything is transformed into Vajra. You don't offer flowers, you offer Vajra flowers. You don't offer candles, you offer Vajra candles. Everything is Vajra. Everything is imbued by meaning, so it's this new level. So the Vajra flowers you offer are because you're offering the very best of it. They're the tantric flowers. Everything can be transformed. Enlightenment in this lifetime. Just bring everything on, imbue everything with meaning. Let's get to it. You know, we can get there. So that's a little overview, and I'm looking forward to hearing what other people say about Tantra. So I'm just going to look at the stupa as a tantric symbol through just having a quick look. This is whistle stop. Through some early stupas, and then the idea of the symbol of personal transformation and the symbol of the cosmos in the stupa. And this is a fantastic little tanka of Ushnisha Vijaya. So she's there in the centre. There's a stupa in the centre. She's got Avalokiteshvara on one side and Vajrapani on the other side. She's in the centre of the stupa, surrounded by 108 stupas, and she's got sort of wrathful deities down the bottom here, and the stupa's on a lotus. So it's sort of, it's elevated, isn't it? It's no longer just a stupa on the ground, it's a cosmic stupa, or sort of imagined stupa. So early stupas, we can all probably recognise this stupa. So all stupas like this. So this one's at Sanchi. And we know probably the story of the founding of the stupas. Let's see what I've put next. Yeah. So the stupa is a funerary monument to start with. So it holds the relics of the Buddha, or sometimes it was built for a king, or sometimes a revered teacher. So the story in our tradition is that Ananda says to the Buddha, you know, when you're gone, how shall we remember you? The Buddha doesn't say anything, but he takes his robe and he folds it into a sort of square, and he takes his begging bowl and he turns it upside down and puts it on top of the square. So you've got the half moon shape of the bowl sitting on top of the square of the robe, and I think, oops, oh yay, summer sail. If I can go back. Yeah, you can see here. That's kind of how you would imagine that. There, you've got the sort of the round bowl sitting on top of the base. So we'll just, I was just going to say something about relics. So the Sanskrit name for relics is dhatu, which is really interesting. Because we talk about the Dharma dhatu, something that's sort of gone beyond. So the relics are the transformed body of the Buddha, because you know, he's burned on the funeral pyre, so it's not the body of the Buddha anymore. And in fact, some of the most relics aren't necessarily body relics. They get transformed into these little magical beads. I mean, we do have tooth relics and bone relics and things like that, but there's something about these magical beads. They're not even really the body of the Buddha. They're the transformed body of the Buddha. And the relics make his absence present. So the Buddha is no longer with us. He's now sort of physically absent. But we feel him, you know, like we've got the sense of the Buddha. So the relics and the stupa, they make that kind of present, especially for the early Buddhists. So they're a visible way to reconcile this contradiction between knowing that the Buddha has gone beyond and his presence is kind of with us somehow. So how do we sort of do that? And I suppose in our culture, the relics are the remainder of someone. So they're the bones and the ashes and then what's left over once that person has been cremated or died. You know, it might be a lock of hair or something like that that's a relic. But it's not like that in Buddhist practice. It's not like it's the leftover of the Buddha. The Buddha is definitely gone. It's something different. And to be honest, I haven't really got my head around exactly what that is. It's a different form of presence. They often retell a tale. So stupas are often packed full of amulets and figures of the Buddha. There's an earthquake and the sort of stupa opens up. There'll be the sort of the life of the Buddha inside, with the Buddha's enlightenment, his birth, and all that sort of inside, all hidden. And also on the outside, the life of the Buddha was told. So they kind of continue the biography of the Buddha in a way. And they embody the whole of the Buddha's coming and going, this idea of coming and going. And I won't go into all of this, but there's... otherwise, I must type myself. but if you go from the bottom up, you've got the sort of the gate here at the side. You can see this tall gate, and there are four gates at the four cardinal directions, and they represent different aspects of the Buddha's life story. And there's the fence that goes round, so it's a stone fence, but it would have once been a woven fence, and that delineates the sacred space from the sort of worldly space. Then you've got the sort of the medhi, the ritualistic pathway to circumambulate the stupa. So you've got this sort of big sort of this sort of preparation into the stupa, and then you've got the dome, which is the ancient burial mound. And in early Buddhist stupas, it was often considered to be shaped like an egg, sort of representing an egg. An egg is kind of the universe, or sort of breaking open. It's a sort of ancient Vedic symbol for the world. And then on the top, in the square, is the hamika, and that's the receptacle of the relics, and over that an umbrella. And you'll see how those the umbrella, you get more and more umbrellas. So the hamika is interesting because that's kind of like part of it, that's way up there, perhaps is a sort of development of the eye of the Vedic altar where they did fire rituals. And this is a stupa in Taxila, in what was ancient Gandhara, is now Pakistan. And you can sort of see how huge it is. So this is an archaeological site. Everything that's around it. This is a stupa in Sri Lanka. And we can just sort of, I'm just sort of showing that classic stupa shape. And actually you can see later on, it's almost like a precursor of the Nepalese stupas, isn't it? You can imagine some eyes on the top of that hamika and some prayer flags coming out. But you can see sort of the size of the stupa and the area to circumambulate and sort of the movement up. So this is our original stupa as a funerary mound. There's lots more to say about that. So now I'm just going to look at the stupa as a symbol of personal transformation. So Alvia, here we go. Here are some eyes painted on that hamaka. So this is Swayambhuna in Nepal. Great, so back to the yogis. So here's Milarepa, which I'm sure a lot of you know. So he was a yogi practicing in the mountains of Tibet, as you can see from his sort of picture. And above him is his guru, Marpa, and then above him is Vajradhara. So you've got this sort of lineage, sort of emphasises that lineage, which is so important to Vajrayana. So yogic practice. So this is the stupa as personal transformation. So the meditation practice of the yogis was about transforming this individual energy concentrated within the body. So it's a kind of different way of looking at it, slightly different to I think dhyanic meditation, or they just formulated it differently. So they started to work with the energy centres in the body, so started to work with the chakras. And these chakras, they noticed, were points where the energy came and went. So there were these sort of psychic, cosmic and psychic energies, crystallised into body energy and then transmuted again into psychic energy. So they had this sort of, they noticed sort of energy pathways within the body. So there were these two streams of movement, a sort of fiery ascending and a sort of liquid descending. And you still get that with the Vajrasattva practice, the sort of the drops of the white liquid sort of dropping onto your head. So this is taken just from Lama Govinda. So he tries to sort of, he sort of links then this idea of yogic practice and the chakras with the stupa. So this is now, well, let's just have a look at it. So we've got the, so we've got on this side, we've got the idea of the root center. So on the left-hand side, the navel center, the heart center, the throat center, the brain center. So we've got our chakras. And we've got the energy that moves up from the root center through. But it sort of also comes back down through those centres to our Om Ah Hum. And you might notice sometimes when we salute the shrine, you know, we might go Om Ah Hum. You know, these are the most sort of primordial mantric sounds. So there's this idea of sort of energy ascending and becoming more subtle. So that's why on the side here, on the other side, we've got this idea of earth, water, fire, air. So the ancient elements and space that holds them. So when we're thinking about earth in terms of tantric practice and earth in terms of these elements, it's not the earth, it's earth qualities. It's not water as in water, it's water qualities. It's not literal fire, it's like fiery qualities, air qualities, qualities of solidity, of a bit more movement, of more movement, we get very ascending, air that can sort of move in every direction, and then space that kind of holds it all. So the sort of meditation of the yogis, they started to use the stupa, or use the chakras, and they sort of mapped it kind of onto the stupa, or they developed their own tantric stupa in relation to what their experiences were in meditation. It's just an image you find on the internet. So many bad images, so many when you're looking for good ones. But I don't know, I quite liked it. This idea of this sort of the energy ascending. And as the colours here aren't the colours that we usually associate with. So you do have to just be careful when you're looking, using for images. So here we go. Here's back to the original stupa from India. So we've got the sort of the stairs leading up. We've got the garba. Garba means womb. So the egg. We've got the harmika. And we can see sort of how it transfers into the Tibetan stupa, and how then that transfers into this what's called the tantric stupa. So these cubes, sphere, cone, cup and drop, that's the tantric stupa. It's been the architectural element's completely gone. It's now just about energy. Yeah. So in yogic and tantric practice, the stupa is transformed into a symbol for the psychophysical energies of meditation. So there's correlations between the chakras, the elements, the five Buddha mandala, mantric sound and colour. There's tons and tons to say on this. And actually, if Bhante gives a really excellent talk on it. And there's a little booklet, symbols of the tantric path, and the stupa's in there. So there's tons and tons on that. That you can read. So there's all these correlations, and so the symbol of the stupa is then transposed onto the human body, and it's used for liberation. So the stupa is now, and the person sort of, and the person's energies, energy fields, sort of come together in the tantra. And so here's the tantric stupa again, and then next to it is a Tibetan idea of the human body and the stupa. So there's no, it's not really very, very fixed. Some schools will show the base at the earth, like the folded legs of the earth. In Tibet, they often do it like this. But you've definitely now got the sort of the person and the stupa sort of together. And I just sort of threw this in because I really, really like it. So then this is a tanka. And so at the front side, we have our lama at the front, and we've got our lineage, and all his teachers and everyone around him. But on the back side is all the mantric sounds which consecrate and bring the presence of those figures into the tanka. So these are probably Om Ah Hum, I think. All this is Om Ah Hum, Om Ah Hum, Om Ah Hum, and they relate to the figures here. And he is he's put into a stupa. So the form of his body is the form of the stupa now. And those two are one. And he is, it'll probably be Om and Hum will be in here somewhere. So that those seed syllables will sort of relate to his body. So the stupa is the energy field for that lama, and it makes him present in that tanka and holds him in that tanka. So it went sort of that far. So now we've got the idea of the stupa as a symbol for the cosmos. So that's the mandala. So we're it's the Kala Chakra mandala. So the Kala Chakra mandala is a depiction of the universe. So it's an idea of the universe, and it's given a two-dimensional representation here. So it's a mandala, but let's see where this takes us. So this is the cosmos according to the Kala Chakra. You've got to remember this is sort of medieval thinking, and it sort of works a little bit well. So around everything is space, and then we've got this brown disc which represents air, and then we've got a fire disc and a water disc and an earth disc. So things are becoming more solid because it's sort of getting more gross in a way. And then at the centre of everything is Mount Meru. So Mount Meru is, you don't have to take this in all detail, it's just a sort of symbol really. Mount Meru is this sort of red energy sort of going up, and around it is this web of the planetary movements. And then also you've got the worlds of the gods ascending up. So you've got the worlds of the gods ascending up, the Nagas and the Asuras, and then you know up into the sort of four heavens of the mental bodied gods. So this is the universe according to the Kala Chakra. And we're kind of here. This is the planets and the seas, where the jumbled Vipa is down there in the south. We're sort of located there, sort of in the ocean, as a continent in the ocean. But it's an interesting shape, isn't it? And if you turn that into a 3D shape, as this person's done here, you can see that it's got quite a stupa-like appearance. And he's in this particular book. He's put it side by side with an ancient stupa, which also goes up again. And that's what the cosmos does. So there's this real link between the stupa and the cosmological view of the world at that time. So, And important in this is this axis that runs through the stupa. So we saw it right at the beginning with the umbrella emerging from the stupa. But embedded in Tibetan stupas and in other old stupas as well, is this central sort of pole that runs through. And it's the axis of the world. So it runs through the Kala Chakra as well. And it's Mount Meru, but it's also the cosmic tree. So apparently Indra, when he was sort of stirring the, was he stirring the cosmic milk of the world or the seas? He planted this stick and he used it to join heaven and earth. And so out of that grows the colour chakra, but out of that also grows the cosmos. And out of that also is the stupa and the stupa symbolism. So, so that's here in a you can see in the sort of cross-section of a Tibetan stupa. And it's hard to see here, but on this wood, which is often of it's called the life wood of the stupa, and it's made of sandalwood and other sorts of things. It's got inscribed on it Om Ahom Tam and Hui, so the symbols of the tantric stupa that we saw, or of the five Buddha mandala. They're all sort of coming together within this. So the stupa is both ending up sort of like both as a sort of like the sacred mountain, the world tree, and a sort of symbol of the universe within this one sort of monument. So yeah, and I thought it was interesting, in Tibetan, sacred mountains are referred to as the pillar of heaven and the earth dagger axis. So that's a mountain. And the stupa is also this sort of mountain, Mount Meru, right there, holding it through. And this is another view of Sanchi stupa, and this idea of how you move around the stupa. So it's made with the swastika. So Lama Govinda wonders whether the first mandalas may have been created by when you sort of took stupa and you added the railing to it, and then you added the gateways to it. And so you have the stupa in the middle, but then you turn it into something else. You turn it into this view of the cosmos, and you enter and you interact with it. So you enter and you circumambulate, and you're having a different experience of the life of the Buddha, but also a view walking around this monument. You're walking around this world mountain in a way, or this sort of this great story of universal enlightenment. And then here's Borobudur, so it's the ultimate mandala universe stupa. Is it a stupa or is it a mandala? It doesn't really matter, actually. It's kind of both things. But you you engage with Borobudur by this ascent through these different levels of earth, fire, earth. Oh no, it's the other way around. Anyhow, that there's different levels through to the top to this five. Well, it's this five Buddha mandala, but on a sort of cosmic scale. So right in the centre is the Buddha, but the Buddha in the central stupa is hidden. So you can't see the Buddha in the central stupa, but we know it's there. So it's a sort of cosmic mandala. Cosmic mandala stupa. So the stupa then represents the whole cosmos, and we can engage with it, or you know, you could in these sorts of contexts, as the whole universe. So there's this sense from the personal experience of energy as a sort of as a yogi and the sort of the stupa energies. Or the sort of energies of this sort of enlightenment sort of in your own experience. So that's the microcosm, but it kind of links then with the big picture. You can sort of also take it out into this big picture of the universe. And I suppose that kind of perspective opens you right out, doesn't it? So that in Tantra, you know, sort of the you're sort of trying to break through a subject-object sort of polarization. So you're sort of identifying more and more. You can identify those energies and experiences within your own meditation with your own experience, and you can then sort of see them when you engage with other sort of practices, like sort of engaging with the stupa, or see them in sort of the whole world system. Yeah, so the stupa as a symbol of transformation. So initially the stupa is a symbol of the presence of the Buddha. It's then taken up as a symbol for transformation of psychophysical energies, so the tantric stupa in that way. And then it can be taken out even further to a symbol of the cosmos and of universal energy. So then we've got these correlations between the microcosm and the macrocosm. And then I suppose that non-dual experience of outer and inner, that sort of wordless experience, takes you right back to the Buddha, really, and the Buddha's experience of enlightenment, and the Buddha present within the stupa, so that ultimately the stupa becomes a symbol of great enlightenment, and it can be a symbol of our own enlightenment, not just the Buddha's enlightenment. So...